Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me today for a very special episode indeed, because, first of all, in this episode, the film under discussion is Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity from 1944, starring Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck, and Edward G. Robinson. And another reason this is a special podcast is because it's our first crossover episode, because I'm joined by the guys from the great IMDb-oriented podcast for 250. So let me say hello, first of all, to Darren Mooney. Hi, Darren.
Hello. How are things?
Not bad at all. And people will remember, long-term listeners of the Movie Palace will remember you, of course, from our discussion about Gilda not so long ago. But let me also say hello to your co-host on the 250, your co-presenter, Andrew Quinn. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Carl. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. And it's a pleasure to talk to you, because like Darren, I've spoken to before on the Movie Palace and other podcasts, but I've never had the pleasure of speaking to you. So yeah, really looking forward to this.
It's great to be invited. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. We're really, really looking forward to this. It's always great to sort of to cross over and to have a conversation with another podcast.
Learn something from proper podcasters.
And sort of, yeah, to observe and to steal all of your ideas. That's basically why we're here.
It's like, oh, I like that.
Yeah, we'll take that. That's a good hook they have there. But yeah, no, so I was thrilled to sort of guest on the Movie Palace a couple of weeks ago talking about Gilda, which was great fun. And we thought that we should do it again sometime, and maybe we should come over to each other's places and talk about a movie that's kind of in both of our interests. So a movie that would be both belong to the classic age of Hollywood and on the 250.
And a delight.
Ooh.
So it, yeah.
And I think for that reason, like the joy of this movie wasn't obviously for being so high on the IMDb list. I think it was so refreshing to watch one of those classic golden age Hollywood movies, and this movie very much is
it sort of typifies that sort of like old school aesthetic, because it's worth talking about this actually just in terms of like the IMDb 250, because again this is a show about the list in some way, shape and form. It's worth noting that there are, I know everybody loves when Darren takes out the list and the statistics and the numbers.
I just said a moment ago, obviously we weren't interested in this because of its ranking on the,
the 250. And Darren's like, oh, don't worry, I have stats and charts.
Let me tell you, out of 26,759 votes, you know what the most frequent rating was? And it's like, no, tell us.
we're very riveted. This is very exciting. but no, I just think one of the things that's interesting about the 250, we talked about this in the podcast before, is that it's a list that reflects a very certain like sensibility of movie going, a very certain sense of cinephilia, very certain sort of like sense of being a movie fan, a very sort of like codified sense of what good movies are and what we define as the movies that are important. And sort of noting that like a lot of those movies are geared towards like the 90s, as you might expect for a website that has a target audience of young men who would have came of age during the 90s. So do you want to take a guess and guess how many movies are on the list from the period of 1940 through to 1949?
Right. Well, we discussed the 1930s, didn't we, on my podcast? And I believe the number was seven, was it? And
so, yes, it
so
was.
My guess would be for the 40s, but it goes up a bit. So I'm gonna plump for 15.
Oh, lower.
10?
It's 11. It's 11 on there. There's 25 from the 50s, there's 16 from the 60s, and then it sort of gradually builds through the 70s, the modern day. So the 40s, that sort of golden age of Hollywood, is very much sort of underrepresented on a list of the top 250 movies ever made, which is kind of strange when you look at it, because obviously that's a period that dominates more sort of prestigious lists, like the AFI list, for example, the BFI list, if you want to pick other examples. But it's very much, it seems like when you get to the IMDb 250, there's very much a recency bias, a modernity bias in some ways. So it's kind of, it was very interesting for us, myself and Andrew, to watch the film and to sort of come and talk to it. Because I think it's the first film we've covered from that period. We covered like The Third Man a little while. Sorry, we covered Touch of Evil a little while ago from the 50s. And I think we covered The General from the 20s. We covered, we did cover It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes, we also did Mr. Smith.
That's right.
That's 1939.
Washington. Oh, yeah.
1939, yeah.
But relatively speaking, we're 104, 105 episodes into the podcast, and we can count on one hand the number of movies we covered from before 1950, which
I'm happy with the amount we've done. Like, because the thing is that I find most of the movies in the cinema these days were released in 2018. So so it's not often I get to see a movie from the 30s or 40s. This this podcast that we have, I think, has resulted in us watching some. While there could be more representation of it, it's kind of like it's just so democratic. Mm. That's I mean, you have to almost rejoice when you find that one of the kind of usual suspects. Yeah. Hasn't popped up. I believe the usual suspects is
one of the usual suspects.
One of the usual suspects. Yeah.
But that's the IMDb perspective. What about your own, Carl? What do you make of like? So what is your impression of Double Indemnity?
I mean, this is a film that's long been a favorite of mine. So it's actually quite an interesting challenge to kind of prepare for this, really, because I'd never really had to sort of sit down and think about why it's a favorite. You know, it's not a film I've ever like written about anywhere. Never podcasted about it before, never really talked about it much generally, because, you know, one of the things with me is like a lot of my friends aren't really film fans, and if they are, they're not always kind of au fait with older stuff, you know. But no, I mean, I love this film for a lot of reasons, to be honest. I think that there was actually a line that jumped out at me this time, which I hadn't kind of picked up on before, but it kind of encapsulates why. It's when it's later on when the character Keyes, played by Edward G. Robinson, says about the crime, you know, it all fits together like a watch. And when I'm watching this film, it's like, you know, I just feel like I'm in the grip of storytellers who know exactly what they're doing. They're in complete control. And it contrasts quite nicely, I think, then, Darren, with the film you and I discussed previously, Gilda, where I don't feel there's that kind of level of finesse and control at play in that film. But here I really do. And it's a feeling I often get when I'm watching Billy Wilder's films in general, to be honest. And it's certainly an important film. I mean, you talked about the time period and so on. I think it's important to the way noir develops. But even if you set that aside, I think it's still a fabulous entertainment. I think it's a really masterful adaptation of the novella by James M. Cain. And it's just, it's also, as well, a really good example of fine casting, too, I think. So there are lots of reasons why I like Double Indemnity. Why I love Double Indemnity, but those are a few of them, I suppose.
It's worth noting, actually, when you mentioned the idea of like this being a usually influential film noir, you know, most people wouldn't say it's the first. Most people point to earlier films, for example, but it is one of the first formative ones. And in particular, Adam Frost at the BFI, he singled this out as the most noiriest noir that ever noired, I think is exactly how he phrased it. But
I was just thinking the same thing. And you mentioned Billy Wilder, and you mentioned the it being an adaptation. It was Raymond Chandler also.
Raymond Chandler worked on the script. This had a very, very interesting story in getting from development to screen, because it was based on Cain, who wrote the book. He originally began as a crime reporter, and he covered the Ruth Snyder case in the late 20s, which is famous for a number of reasons, including it was the first shot of a person being executed that was printed on the first page on the front page of an American newspaper. But the case was basically this woman had conspired with this other party to murder her husband for the insurance money. And that served as the basis of two of Cain's hugely influential novellas. The first one being The Postman Always Rings Twice. And then this one as well. And the issue was with this...
They're similar.
Oh, yeah. Well, they are quite similar. And, I mean, like, they're... Cain is a hugely influential writer just based on those two stories alone.
He's like an angry guy.
A very, very angry guy. A very cynical guy. And I mean, one of the things is that when he shopped around... So the novella, I think, was originally published, was it Liberty Magazine, in 8 parts?
Yep.
It was a relatively short story. But he basically shopped it around Hollywood. And again, the... Breen at the Hayes office sort of shut this down by sending a memo around the studio saying there was no way that this sort of salacious story could ever be made into a film because it's just so gratuitous and sleazy and without
People
any moral...
will love it.
Yeah. And without any moral...
we
morally...
can't have this.
Yeah. And without any morally redeeming features or anything like that. And it's kind of... So
what we really want is those movies that have kids with pigtails in them.
Yeah. Can we shoehorn a kid with pigtails into this one? What is it? It's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Yes. The Boxcar Massacre. But They shopped it around. In fact, Kane would complain later on that Breen, basically at the Hayes office, had delayed the production of the film so much that it cost him $10,000. Kane would become a very litigious figure. In fact, like, you talk about the influence that this movie had on later noirs, Kane would famously try and sue the writer of every film noir that included a plot with an adulterous wife or attempt to murder a husband, a dame, voiceover narration, stuff like that. But he was very litigious. He didn't win any of the cases, but he always went to the Writers Guild claiming that he'd been ripped off for like virtually every important film noir that had followed.
Surely, they were juicing Chandler to get it even noirier.
Well, yeah. Well, the story with Chandler is fantastic. I suspect you know some of this, Carl. The story between, like, the dynamic that existed between Chandler and Billy Wilder, which is apparently legendary in sort of Hollywood circles.
Yeah, they had a bit of a tetchy relationship, is what I understand. Even down to, I think Wilder turned up for work one day and Chandler had kind of submitted a memo to a producer or somebody, kind of complaining about all of Wilder's kind of habits that kind of were kind of off-putting to Chandler, things like wearing his hat indoors and stuff like this. But
yeah, my personal favorite, well, yeah, Chandler really didn't like that. Like, this is the thing, when Wilder had obviously read, like, The Big Sleep.
Really glad I live now.
But, like,
and not in an age where people complain about hats indoors.
Yeah, I know, people complain about people being very sensitive now.
Yeah.
But, like, there's this thing with Wilder where Wilder had read The Big Sleep, which was obviously the big Raymond Chandler book, and it's wonderful, it's noir, it's got this heavy atmosphere, it's got this wonderful prose, and he expected from that when Chandler showed up, he'd be like this grisly, like, private detective type figure with, like, this American accent, chewing a toothpick, with these wry one-liners and observations on human nature. And what Wilder got, in his own words, was a middle-aged accountant.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what this movie needed in parts. I'm certainly an actuary.
But just on the differences, like, the reason why Chandler complained about Wilder wearing his hat indoors was because Chandler claimed that it created an atmosphere where he was afraid that Wilder would leave. It created an atmosphere of uncertainty. He was never sure whether Wilder was going to leave the room or not because he was always wearing his hat. Chandler was apparently a very awkward person to work with. He famously showed up at this first studio meeting and said, I will write this under two conditions. First condition is, you must pay me at least $700 to write this script. And the second condition is that I must have at least a week to write it. And the studio executives were like, okay, I think we can meet those conditions. Famously, when he did write it in a week, and then Wilder read it and apparently threw it across the room and basically insisted that they rewrite it together. Chandler famously struggled with alcoholism while writing. And in particular, like, it's been argued that, like, after Wilder made this film, he made The Lost Weekend. Yes. Which apparently won, it like swept the Oscars in that year. And many have argued that it was like Scorsese winning for The Departed. It was like a retroactive Oscar, retroactive recognition for this film, which was nominated for 7 Oscars but won 0. But The Lost Weekend is a story of, like, alcoholism and depression and this sort of spiral of self-destruction. And Wilder has argued, and I guess it depends on how much you read the dynamic between, like, Chandler and Wilder as either mutual fascination or mutual hatred. But it was either Wilder basically delivering one gigantic screw you to Chandler in the form of, like, his next Oscar-winning movie. Yeah. Or more charitably, it was Wilder trying to understand Chandler, trying to get underneath his skin. Because, like, there's, even within this film, there's copious amounts of alcohol consumption in there. There's a moment where
it wouldn't be a
a 50s film noir. Sorry, 40s film noir.
Without that. The thing you said about the hat reminded me of something in the movie where the president is chastising him for not wearing an overcoat.
Yeah.
Or for not wearing a blazer. Yeah. Yeah, it's like he has a three-piece suit with two.
There's another aspect to the Wilder Chandler relationship, which I thought was interesting in the way Wilder told it anyway, which was that, you know, Wilder had quite an active romantic life apparently. So he's taking calls from various women during the day while they're trying to be, you know, while they're sat working on the script. And Chandler, I think, was kind of a single man who didn't really have the same kind of attention. So I think Wilder kind of supposed there was a bit of jealousy between the two men. But I think that, you know, whatever the tensions that were evident, their collaborative work on the film ultimately was superb. And another kind of fascinating wrinkle to that is that Chandler was apparently pretty contemptuous of James M. Cain. You know, wasn't really a fan of his writing at all. Even though there are some things that problematize this, I think there's one or two memos from Chandler to Cain and back, you know, back and forth, where they're kind of a bit more pleasant with each other. But I think Chandler is on record as being, you know, kind of looking down his nose at Cain's writing. And it sounds to me, from what I've read about the way Wilder and Chandler work, that they thought really carefully about how you transfer Cain's dialogue to the screen. Because what they sort of discovered early on is, like, what works on the page just didn't really work so well when it was coming out of the mouths of actors, you know. So I think one thing they managed to do really well is they kind of retain the harshness of the original story. But they sort of streamline, you know, they make all these structural improvements, but they also inject, I think, the wit that I find, you know, really something to cherish about this film.
Yeah. That's one of the first things I thought when I was looking at the credits for this movie at the beginning. Because I knew nothing about this. That's generally where I come in. And it's generally where I leave a movie. but seeing Billy Wilder, based on my limited kind of knowledge of Billy Wilder movies, I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. But then the opening kind of shots were, and the music kind of led me to believe, and the title of the movie led me to question whether this was going to be one of these farcical Billy Wilder movies.
It's not quite Some Like It Hot.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's most people's kind of even people who haven't seen a lot of old movies, or people who haven't done a deep dive of Billy Wilder, will have seen Some Like It Hot at least.
Or The Apartment or whatever. But I mean, this is the thing. This was only Wilder's third film, which is remarkable.
Yeah, only his third film. And I think a lot of people have argued that this is the first one that really, you know, is a Billy Wilder film through and through, you know. And I think, you know, if we're going to talk about Wilder in general, I think he is a great filmmaker. And it's kind of like you're touching on there, Andrew, like he excelled in a range of genres. So, yeah, a lot of people would associate him with Some Like It Hot or The Apartment or whatever. But for me, I think my favourites of his would be this film, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard. And he did a film with Kirk Douglas called Ace in the Hole, which has kind of had a bit of a rediscovery in the last kind of decade or two. But I think in general, Wilder is just a great example of the kind of energising effect that, like, European migrants had on Hollywood cinema at this time, you know. But he's also got this great, like, cynicism running through his body of work that I just find delicious. You know, that's one of the things I like best about all those films I mentioned. But he seems like he's kind of alive to the rhythms and, you know, the cadences, like the particular cadences of, like, American English, in a way that maybe that's kind of his migrant status he's kind of bringing to bear on it. But, you know, kind of dialogue that would seem cliched to other people, he just seems to kind of take it and run with it, you know. I mean, I know he often worked with co-writers, like he'd work prolifically with a guy called Charles Brackett, obviously Chandler here, and then he's got a long-term collaborator after IAL Diamond. But I still think, you know, I think Wilder deserves a lot of credit for that too, to be honest.
Oh yeah, there's definitely a lot in Wilder's work of the sort of like the outsider looking in at like American culture and stuff like that. I mean, I listened to the commentary on the disc before we sort of watched the movie itself, and they talk a little bit about how like Wilder has strenuously denied the sort of various influences that people have tried to place on the work. So for example, you know, this film was made in the middle of the Second World War, but it's consciously set in 1938, and Wilder has denied the idea that it was influenced by the Second World War. He's also denied that it was influenced by Chandler's other work, even though like Chandler's a writer on it, for example, as well. But there is this sense of like an outsider looking in, and you get a lot. I think you're right when you point to like the immigration of European directors like to America in the 30s and 40s for obvious reasons, and the sort of like the outsider sort of looking in, because like when you watch Double Indemnity, it feels very much like it's almost like a sort of a stylized version of America. Like, I don't know. I wasn't alive in like 1938 where the film set, or 1943 when the film was made. I don't know if people used baby that frequently in conversation or if like they talked about Danes.
It does come across a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if anyone ever will call people baby so much. I mean, we have some time on the podcast to see if we can say baby as many times as they did in the movie. But I don't think we'll get
I don't think we'll get quite enough size.
No.
Probably not. Darren, since you mentioned, since we're still talking generally and you mentioned the commentary, I mean, I noticed you were kind of, you took to Twitter in tabloid parlance, didn't you? You had a few issues with the commentary. And I was just wondering, because I only had a chance to listen to the first few minutes this morning. So I don't think I picked up on what you saw in it. But what was the problem there exactly?
Well, I mean, okay, the commentary is great. It's two people who really know what they're talking about the work of Billy Wilder and talking about like the film and talking about the legacy of the film, some of the production issues of the film. And it's very informative from that point of view. And it's two people who genuinely love the movie. And I genuinely love the movie as well. But you get that towards the end of the commentary, you have this sort of discussion that you tend to fall into when you talk about old films, where you talk about like, you know, they don't make them like this anymore discussion, which is entirely fair. They don't make them like this anymore.
And if they did, then they would be trying specifically to recreate these kind of movies. This is like you said earlier, this is the noiriest.
A noir that ever noired. But yeah. I mean, there's also like within that discussion, and that discussion is fine and it's entirely fair. And I think that it's accurate to say they don't make them like this anymore, just like they don't make them like Apocalypse Now anymore, just like they don't even make them like Pulp Fiction anymore at this point. But it's when you get there, that discussion sort of morphs into like a talk about how films are stupider now and audiences are stupider now and executives have more contempt for audiences now than they used to. And that's an attitude that I find kind of wary and alienating when we talk about old cinema, when we talk about, because I mean, like, old films are fantastic. This is brilliant. This is one of the best films ever made. But you have to keep in mind that at the same time that this was being released, you were having like huge swaths of Westerns released to flood cinemas that were owned by studio chains to make sure that there was a different film every week, where you had films that didn't even barely had scripts that were being sort of sent to, you know, into production and that were being screened and filmed that were forgotten about now, many of which have actually been like destroyed and deleted. Like, there's
the thing that people talk about a lot these days is they say, there's an awful lot of remakes as well, and the remakes aren't very good. But it will be like 15 or 20 years from now that we'll have some of those kind of the good ones that we'll be able to point to
and go back to.
Yeah, and we won't think about like all of the crappy ones that didn't need to get made.
No, nobody's gonna
just disappear into irrelevance.
That's it. 20 years from now, nobody will be talking about The Meg, even if The Meg is a terrible film that's being released right now. And I find that sort of argument, sort of when we talk about old films, I find that there's a tendency to dismiss the now as a moment that has its own merits that are completely separate and not necessarily better or worse than. Like, because I mean,
we don't have any perspective.
Yeah, and also that you're looking at a different thing. So I mean, it's hard to say that like a cinematic climate that produces films like Double Indemnity is that objectively better or worse than a climate that enables films as small as Moonlight or Lady Bird to get made. And it's hard to quantify that for me. And I thought that was one of the issues I had with the commentary that was otherwise very, very informative, very well made. Two people who clearly loved the film and who clearly went deep on Wilder as influences his legacy. And also just in terms of they had a lot of wonderful anecdotes about Wilder, which were really, really fantastic as well.
I mean, I think we've talked about it on this podcast about how, like, I've complained that certain types of movies don't get made anymore. More recent generations of movies,
like the social commentary movies like, of the '80s, Andrew.
Yeah,
said, like,
of the kind of Reagan era sci-fi, where it's always a comment on how everything's getting sold out.
So like Aliens, RoboCop, that sort of stuff.
Well, in terms of, like, obviously the commentary, I haven't heard all of it, so I can't really pass judgment on that. But in terms of the general kind of attitude you're describing, yeah, it definitely sounds like, you know, I'm very wary of like dogmatic thinking, you know, and I think it definitely is true. I think that, you know, because I have a look in like various like Facebook groups and stuff about old movies, sometimes I share the podcast in there and that kind of thing. And this is kind of an attitude you see. It's quite prevalent, it seems to me. I think you also do get the kind of flip side of it too, but maybe it's not quite so widespread, where, you know, maybe not everybody has as good a grasp on film history as you would like, you know, not just movie fans, but maybe reviewers possibly sometimes. And like I say, whenever you get beyond a personal preference for a certain aesthetic style or something like that into kind of rigid dogma, I think that's kind of regrettable, you know.
Yeah, and the other thing I guess to say is that, you can come at it the opposite way and you can say, kind of, movies don't get made like this anymore, and isn't it good that they're not? Because you can, if you're of a certain kind of aesthetic, because you can point at these movies and you can say, the acting isn't quite what it is these days in some cases. Of course, you can. It depends what kind of performance you're looking at and what movie you're looking at. Like, you look at something like Citizen Kane, and all of the actors are coming from theater, and they're all fantastic. But like for example, you look at an older movie and they're all speaking mid-Atlantic, and you have some kind of like performances where it just wouldn't really pass muster these days.
But again, I mean that's an argument, though. That's more doctors differ, patients die. Like, I would have a certain fondness for a stylized performance. Like, I think William Shatner is one of the greatest actors of his generation.
Terms of dialogue as well, like...
I think that there's, like, in American cinema, I think as you get into the 50s, certainly, you get this drive towards naturalism, you know. Yes. And I think it comes out in performance. It comes out in, like, location shooting and stuff like that. So I guess the thing with earlier films is, like, you need maybe... Like the dominant kind of paradigm is a less naturalistic style of acting. So it's not necessarily better or worse in my opinion, but it is, you know, quantifiably different to what comes along when you get people like Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift and, you know, people like that who kind of shake things up a bit, you know?
Yeah. Or if you believe Ethan Hawke, Nicolas Cage, who is the only actor to have done anything interesting with the art form since Marlon Brando. But that's a separate podcast. No,
not De Niro, not De Niro.
No.
He's going, I think Nicolas Cage is going back to a more stylized, less naturalistic. Yeah.
But it's funny you should mention, like, the idea of, like, the canon and the idea of sort of, like, because I do think you have a very fair point in that a lot of people don't necessarily give older movies fair due. It's very hard to convince young people sometimes to watch movies that are in black and white, that are stylized in these ways, that are even in 4.3 aspect ratio as opposed to 16.9. But I do think it's worth noting in terms of, like, having a canon and having sort of this sort of prestigious idea of what movies are. Like, Billy Wilder would famously have been excluded from these. I think Andrew Saras, who was one of the earliest auteurists, famously listed Billy Wilder as one of the most overrated directors in American cinema because he wasn't an auteur in the way that Saras thought that auteurs should be, in the way that Hitchcock was, in the way that Ford was. And I feel like you get that sort of attitude. And even at the time, American cinema sort of looked down at people like Hitchcock. Hitchcock didn't get recognition until, you know, Cahiers du Cinéma over in sort of France sort of acknowledged the work that he was doing.
And this is the list, though, for overrated film directors, because it's based on rating.
Yeah. But that is a bit of a tangent. But yeah, I think, like, Wilder's...
Well, it's really interesting, because with Hitchcock, like, I've just recently been reading a book of criticism by, you know, the novelist Graham Greene. He was writing film criticism at the time. He was also writing stuff like Brighton Rock and stuff like that. And it's just striking to me because he really wasn't a fan of Hitchcock. And then he came back and wrote, you know, when this book was published, he comes back in like the early 70s, I think, and he does a foreword. And he's kind of still unapologetically, you know, not a Hitchcock fan. And you're definitely right about the, you know, the kind of shifting attitudes on Wilder and stuff like that. And I wonder if it was maybe people didn't as readily see like an identifiable visual style with him like they did with people like Hawks or Ford. Maybe that's why, I'm not sure. Possibly because he kind of switched between modes and genres so much, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, his framing and his composition, I think, isn't as sort of sharp as many of his contemporaries. And in terms of, like, auteurism, that's what you tend to look at. You look at the sort of the positioning of the camera, the iconic shots and stuff like that. I mean, I think that, like, Double Indemnity has a number of really great shots and sequences. Like, for example, the scene of Barbara Stanwyck coming down the stairs with the anklet shining, which happens, like, twice in the course of the film. It's, like, a wonderful bit of visual storytelling, and not only because it's a great shot.
I don't know. I feel like that anklet was spoken about a lot, and I don't think I ever actually saw the anklet. I think it's difficult to see a gold or silver anklet against a white ankle in black and white.
Well, I wonder if you were distracted by her, like, you know,
her
wig.
her wig.
Yeah, the famous wig, which Wilder...
Well, you couldn't often see it at the same time as her ankles.
There's a story that one of the producers said, you know, we're paying all this money to get Barbara Stanwyck and we've got George Washington, you know, because of the wig. You
know, I mean, Wilder famously, I think even 2 weeks into the shoot, he decided that he absolutely hated the wig, but he didn't have time to go back and reshoot the scenes that they'd already shot with it. So he was sort of stuck with it, which is quite nice.
It's not a great wig. Going back to kind of like Nicolas Cage, I guess we can talk about wigs
And bad hairstyles. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about Double Indemnity. Let's sort of jump into like talking about like the substance of it and the material behind it. In terms of like our podcast, what we normally do is we normally ask sort of three questions before we jump into talk about this. So Carl, I think we'll go first. So the first the three questions we ask are: do you think that this movie belongs on the list of the top 250 movies ever made?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that was an easy one. Second question, and I suspect the answer will be quite similar. I don't know why this is a separate question, okay, but let's go with it. Does it belong on your own personal 250?
It does, and it would be probably quite a bit higher than 88 for me, I must say. Yeah. But I'm actually surprised it was as high as 88. I had a guess. I thought it'd be at about 130 for some reason.
Well, I mean, yeah, a lot of these movies are trailing off. And in fact, this movie is trailing off. I think it's dropped 30 places in the last 10, 15 years. And I mean, we saw the same with Touch of Evil, which we covered a little while ago, where that is Touch of Evil's on the way out. By the time we release this podcast, there's a decent chance that like Touch of Evil won't be in the 250. And that the list tends to happen. Like Dog Day Afternoon, for example, had a very slow and gradual decline through the list, as it tends to happen. There's a very steady churn that happens.
Do we know if this is the top Billy Wilder film? I guess Some Like It Hot's probably got a chance of being higher, or
we can find that out. But before while I go and find that out, do you want?
Yeah, I'm going to ask you then. For people who haven't seen this movie, for people who have seen this movie and are wondering if maybe a second watch might be worth it, would you recommend they stop this podcast, go out and watch it, or if they're listening to this live, I don't know what they do. But would you recommend it?
If somebody's listening to this and has seen the film previously, I'd recommend they continue with the podcast, listen to what we've got to say, and then go back and watch it, I think. I mean, I was wondering about this, like, if you're going to select one film to explain what film noir is to somebody, would this be a good one to show people? And I'm in two minds, to be honest, and I wonder what you guys think, because, like, on the one hand, it's a superb choice, because it's like an archetypal film noir in many respects, you know, that we can kind of touch on. On the other hand, I wonder if you're kind of setting people up for a fall in the sense that most film noirs aren't anywhere near as good as this. So if you show this to somebody first,
everything measures.
You know, there might be a bit of disappointment further along the line. Yeah, so I'd be tempted to go to something earlier and, you know, kind of show people stuff kind of a bit more chronologically, maybe. Maybe something like The Maltese Falcon. But I don't know, you could definitely do worse than selecting this one for that,
Maybe choose a really bad one. Although, do you get people to kind of just
watch a second one?
Tap out of them, yeah, yeah. Get one of those ones that Kane sued.
Over.
Well, when Darren and I were talking about Gilda, and Darren made the very fair point that that's a film that a lot of people, you know, offer as like a backup suggestion, like, oh, you've seen Double Indemnity, you've seen The Big Sleep, well, maybe Gilda's not a bad one to kind of pick out. I wonder if maybe Gilda's a good introduction, because it kind of sums up noir in a lot of ways, but it's so rickety in other respects that you kind of you're leaving people with stuff there, you know, that they can then go off and enjoy the classics afterwards, I suppose. But
you
I don't
can
know.
Sort of climb from that. Just in terms of getting back to the Billy Wilder thing, it's actually the third highest ranked Billy Wilder film on the 250. It's higher than The Apartment. It's higher than Some Like It Hot. It's lower than Sunset Boulevard, and it's lower than Witness for the Prosecution.
Ah, that's fascinating. I haven't actually, I'll confess, I haven't seen Witness for the Prosecution, but I didn't think that was quite so highly regarded generally. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, Sunset Boulevard is at 56, and Witness for the Prosecution is at 65, which is quite impressive.
And there's five in total.
There's five in total, which is quite impressive. I think that
we
like
can't really complain too much about representation
of classic cinema. Yeah. Well, I mean, because you got to keep in mind that like Hitchcock's at 7, Nolan's at 7, Scorsese's at 7, Spielberg's at 7. So Wilder at 5 isn't too bad.
No,
he's doing good. Doing good. Yep.
He's indeed. But yeah, so with that in mind, then Andrew, what about yourself? Would this movie be?
No, it's difficult for me to say, having only seen it yesterday evening, but. I wouldn't have any complaints with it being on the list. And I'm glad that it is. Would it be on mine? Possibly. It possibly would. I mean, it's got lots of things I enjoy. Femme fatales, insurance salespeople,
office politics,
actuaries,
bureaucracy.
And Moira.
It's not just the rates that are Moira. Sorry.
I suppose I enjoy the noiriness of it as well. It reminded me of I guess we'll put it in the show notes, but the I was showing Darren this yesterday evening.
Pause the film so that we could enjoy.
Yeah, there was a podcast called Mike Detective, which kind of like made fun of the whole kind of film noir sort of the genre
style.
Like a PI kind of like akin to Chinatown, but very kind of Chandler-y. And even some of the kind of sequences in this movie.
The opening flirtation seems to have been lifted directly. Andrew broke out giggling during it and had to explain why that was.
Are you talking about the how fast was I going, officer?
Yes.
Suppose I'm a police officer. Suppose I pull you over. it's a very detailed bit of role play you guys are going for there. I kind of admire it.
But for those reasons, like the influence it has and the kind of it's there's a kind of a joy in watching these movies and just kind of them being like this kind of nostalgic artifact in a way, but also just being really enjoyable on their own terms also. I'd be tempted to have it without having the perspective of having kind of gone away from it and come back or anything like that. But would I recommend people go out and see it? Absolutely. Or indeed stay in and see it. If you haven't seen it already, watch it now and then I guess join us on the other side of the spoiler zone.
So, Carl, what is Double Indemnity about for you?
For me, it's about the way a man is derailed by his sexual obsession that kind of emerges for Phyllis Dietrichson, played by Barbara Stanwyck. Unhappily, she wants to bump off her husband, so they hatch a plan to kill him in an elaborate way, so as to claim on the insurance, because there's a double indemnity clause, which I believe they say it means that you get paid double in certain kinds of for certain kinds of deaths. That's kind of
it's like a jackpot. It's like a murder incentive.
It's on page 15 of your policy documents.
Yeah,
it's a little known.
I do love that double indemnity is basically, it's basically like a death jackpot. It's like we're sorry, your spouse only died in a regular boring way, so you only get the regular settlement. However, if they died on a train, it's like ding 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 ding. I like to think they have like a house band in that plays when you get Double Indemnity.
Yeah, unhappily for these main characters played by Fred McMurray and Stanwyck, there's a guy who McMurray works with, Barton Keys, who is determined to kind of get to the bottom of this, isn't it? So the tension then in the film after the murder is like, can they get away with it, I suppose?
And a really enjoyable thing about this movie is it seems kind of like clever in a way that you can kind of figure out. And it's just the right point where you can kind of maybe figure out things before they happen, but also feel happy with yourself that you have figured them out.
Yeah.
And
the film, I think the film is clever.
Yeah.
But what I like about it is that the characters, I don't think, are as clever as they think they are, you know?
Right.
So I think that there's definitely a sense that like Walter Neff's kind of, he thinks he's this tough guy. He's in over his head a bit. And I was thinking about this in terms of casting, and I'm really curious to get both of your takes on this. Because like one of the things I'm really interested about is like film stardom. And I think one reason why this era in particular is fascinating is this was a time where stars and stardom was kind of cultivated and preserved in a very different way to, the way things are now, but the way things developed through the 70s and beyond, I suppose. And what I really like about it is like, what I always think about is like casting a particular star, it's always signifying something, whether we like appreciate it or not. I wonder if this is complicated by like older movies when I think a lot of people come in to see Double Indemnity in 2018. You know, I dare say this is the first time they'll have ever seen Fred McMurray or Barbara Stanwyck or Edward G. Robinson on screen. And I feel like there are some specific kind of resonances that people would have had in 44 that we don't really pick up on today. And I don't think it hurts the film, but I think maybe it changes the way we kind of receive it, if that makes sense.
It does indeed. Like, I mean, because one of the things, I watched the making of documentary on the disc, and I wholeheartedly recommend it for people who are interested in the film. I got the Eureka Master Cinema Edition,
yeah,
or the Blu-ray. And one of the things they say is they talk about how, like, the irony of this is that, like, for Fred McMurray, this movie was casting him very much against type, because to a whole generation of people, McMurray would have been known for the work with Disney. Afterwards, he did like Flubber, he did The Son of Flubber, he did the Absent-Minded mm-hmm. Professor. Even beforehand, he did like, I think, To Darling with Love. He did a whole host of these sort of like soppy romantics or like family-friendly stuff. I mean, he was even like, he became a sitcom dad in, It's My Three Sons, I think, during the 70s. So like McMurray's star persona was of the nice guy, the decent guy, the wholesome guy. And on the making of documentary, they discuss the irony of the fact that like the role that he's most known for and the role that people will most likely go back and watch McMurray and have this be the only McMurray film that they ever watch is the role in which he's playing very much against type. It's like if you were going back and watching a Denzel Washington filmography and the only film you watched on it was Training Day. You'd be like, wow, this Denzel Washington, he's very good at playing really nasty people. This is all that he does. It's really unpleasant. He must have been like a real heavy if you look at the films that he did around this. When you're like, no, this is a film that exists very much in contrast to his star persona. If I recall correctly, it was very hard to cast Double Indemnity precisely because the leads were so deeply, deeply unpleasant.
Yeah, and I was trying to think about this in terms of like, how would the typical moviegoer in 44 have been thinking about this then? And I really do think the casting of McMurray serves the film well, though, in the sense that, like we said, he's associated with these kind of genial roles, genial comedies, wasn't necessarily that highly regarded as an actor overall. So I think this departure for him serves the character well, in the sense that, like I said, he's not as tough as he thinks he is, not as tough as he wants to be. He's not really up to it. He's not really meant for this world. But I think what I was kind of saying is like, I'm not sure contemporary audiences necessarily read that into him so readily, though, you know?
Yeah, it's stuff like that. Neither himself nor Phyllis ever stop to think about the accident that he's had, the broken foot. It seems almost like they're going to stop and say like, oh no, this we
should probably adjust based on this.
Or we need to do this quickly, because if he doesn't claim for this within the next few days, it's going to seem like he didn't realize he had this
policy, which is what sets Keys off.
Yeah. So you're it's things like that make you think that they're maybe not so smart. I mean, Keys is set up as this person who is smart, and he is. It's great to see a person in a movie who's incredibly smart, but it's not in any
nefarious
kind of
way.
Yeah, but and it's also they're not alienating themselves by being smart. In fact, they're admired
for their intelligence.
For their intelligence.
Before we talk about Keys, can we go back to talk about Neff there just for a second? Because one of the things I find interesting, and it's sort of, Carl, when we were talking about like the premise of the film earlier on, you were suggesting how Neff was led astray. One of the things that I find really interesting about Double Indemnity is how it kind of fits with this sort of, there's a subgenre of like particular stories, and it's a very American sort of subgenre, but it's basically like the most boring serial killer subgenre of storytelling, where like you have this idea of a relatively normal guy who's very plain, very pleasant, he's very boring, he works a very boring job. I mean, here Neff even categorized himself as unmarried with no visible scars, as if to say, I'm like the factory model of an American male aged between 30 and 40. I'm the most boring and plain guy you can imagine. And there's a sense that runs through the film,
which we really identified with, Darren.
Yeah, I mean, both of us, really. But like, because it's been argued that like the one of the big differences between Double Indemnity and other film noirs is that the femme fatale, like in most cases, the man is a victim of the woman, or that's the sort of stereotype of the film noir, is that the man is tempted by the woman and commits an act and is therefore doomed by it. But one of the interesting dynamics, and I think it came up in one of the listeners' sort of questions, because you suggested sort of listener feedback on this,
yep,
is the idea that Neff himself is, he kind of wants to do this anyway. Neff is kind of drawn to the idea of like becoming a killer. And it's like, this isn't something that fundamentally changes him. It's a catalyst in the sense that we use catalyst in like a chemical sense. It just accelerates a change that he was always going to make. Because he talks about like, when he's recording his confession, he's like,
"So we just sat there. She started crying softly like the rain on the window. And we didn't say anything. Maybe she had stopped thinking about it, but I hadn't. I couldn't, because it was all tied up with something I'd been thinking about for years. Since long before I ever ran into Phyllis Diedrichson. Because, you know how it is, Keys. In this business, you can't sleep or try to figure out all the tricks they could pull on you. You're like the guy behind the roulette wheel, watching the customers to make sure they don't crook the house. And then one night, you get to thinking how you could crook the house yourself. And do it smart. Because you've got that wheel right under your hands. You know every notch in it by heart. And you figure all you need is a plant out front. A shill to put down the bet. Suddenly the doorbell rings and the whole setup is right there in the room with you."
And there's this sense that he's been waiting for an opportunity to break bad, as it were. Walter White being another example of the man who always wanted to be, who always wanted an excuse to be monstrous, and finally took it when it was presented to him. And Neff seems like that kind of person when I watched the film.
Well, I saw it in a slightly different way, in the sense that like when I was watching this film, a quote came to mind that I think is usually attributed to Sophocles, but I think it's kind of disputed who actually said it. And he said that like the male libido is like being shackled to a madman. And I think it's applicable here, because I sort of see it as, you know, Neff's reason, you know, gets kind of blinded by his desire for Stanwyck, I think. And I think McMurray puts it across really well, you know, like we've kind of touched on those initial flirtations, you know, he's kind of testing the limits. He can't keep his eyes off her ankles and all this kind of stuff. So I just like the idea that like sexual attraction is kind of a corrupting influence here. And I mean, we don't need to get too personal or anything, guys. No. But the idea that you can kind of be blinded when you're kind of head over heels for someone, I suppose, or when you're kind of lusting after someone, is a powerful one, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. I mean, Darren doesn't know what you're talking about, but I do agree.
We're talking about getting too personal here. But
as well, I think it's interesting, because I think it's subtly suggesting that he's lusting after this woman, and that they seem to finally consummate on the sofa. And there's perhaps a suggestion that maybe it wasn't all he had expected it to be, because afterwards there are reasons in the story why he doesn't want to spend any time with her. But I got the sense from watching it that maybe he had this like fantasy in his mind that didn't live up to it, and now all of a sudden he wants to spend all the time with the daughter.
Yeah, well, there's the line where like she actually says, "Walter, you don't really care if we see each other or not," later in the film, and there's this wonderful sense, and I love that, like, and kind of Keyes uses this metaphor throughout where he talks about like committing murder. It's like getting on a train with somebody. You're stuck and you can't get off without the other person, and the last stop is the cemetery. And I remember watching that and thinking, that's a really cynical depiction of marriage that he's talking about, basically. It's like, you know, it's like you're now stuck with this person for life, basically.
You're in a sexless carriage. Yeah. You don't know where it's going.
Well, In terms of their physical relationship, that's a really interesting take, and I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, but I think you're definitely right. There's the suggestion, I think, that, you know, they've consummated the relationship there, because it comes back from the voiceover, doesn't it? And he's reclining on the sofa smoking, she's fixing a lipstick and so on. So I think that's definitely the suggestion that they've kind of had sex. I was thinking about this in terms of an issue Darren raised when we were chatting before about Gilda, where I think, if I'm not kind of butchering what you said, Darren, you were sort of saying, you know, because of the Hayes office and all that kind of thing, often these films can't really be about what they're really about. And I was wondering about how this applies to Double Indemnity. And I think in a funny sort of way, I think the relatively chaste presentation of those two kind of serves the story quite well, in the sense that I sort of saw him as being still on the hook, you know, but he wants a bit more from Phyllis, but they can't really be together for various reasons. And I think the fact they're not constantly together in too explicit a way actually serves proceedings quite well here. But I'm curious what you thought.
I'd be more of a sense that I think that the and again, I don't want to be too complaining. We're going to get to talk about the end when we talk about the end. I think like the constraints of like 1940s cinema were most obvious in the ending of the film, which we'll talk about when we get there.
Yeah.
I actually like the sexless quality of the movie, because I mean, everybody knows sex was invented in the 1950s, but the sexless quality of the movie kind of works well for me, because it makes it seem like Neff is less interest. I never really bought into Neff being entirely invested in the sex. I never believed that Neff is sort of lusting in a real tangible way.
And yet Carol and I did.
Which is very strange. I see this more as like Neff having like a dirty weekend, or it's like, okay, I'm gonna break all the rules. I'm gonna go out there, I'm gonna break bad, I'm gonna do everything that society expects me not to do. And adultery is just like one of the things on the checklist that includes murder and insurance fraud.
That's entirely not the case. Okay. I think it's coming from your perspective, Darren. Who's been well behaved for all of his life,
and just one day dreams of like getting away with massive insurance.
So that's almost the more arousing thing.
The vicarious thrill of outwitting my coworkers.
Darren and I both work for a cautiously undisclosed financial services company. So we spend our time thinking
about the ways that we could crook the roulette wheel, so to speak.
I think some of what we're talking about is probably a function of the fact that there's this constant dancing around the production code. Of course, I think the only reason Double Indemnity could have been made at this point, even a few years earlier, it would have been tricky, is that I think there'd been a very, very slight kind of liberalisation in the kind of interpretation of the code in the early 40s, and then all of a sudden, you know, adapting something like Double Indemnity becomes more of a real prospect, you know. So I think that's tying into it. I also think there's a kind of a sense that the real love story here, I mean, you mentioned the character of Lola, but we shouldn't forget the character of Keyes, really. You know, the male relationship between Neff and Keyes is kind of integral too, isn't it?
It is.
Absolutely.
And they're the characters who say I love you to one another.
Now, yeah.
And I don't think
it's great.
I don't think it's explicitly. I don't think it's as coded homoerotically as we talked about Gilda. No. Gilda is one of like the great gay love stories of the code era, in that it's very much a story about two men who are happy until a woman shows up. I think it's that
article from The Onion where it's clarifying that Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street weren't gay; they were pansexual perverts who would do anything to get themselves off, not any particular kind of inclination
or orientation
or description or identity. Yeah,
I definitely agree with Darren. I mean, I was thinking, should I come on the podcast and try and kind of make this case that, you know, there is this homoerotic, are these overtones in their pairing? I don't think there are, but.
I mean, you can read it. Like, there's like, they put cigarettes in each other's mouths and light them. If you want to make a Freudian like subtextual reading, you can. But I never really bought that. I think like Neff, I think the love is platonic, and I think that Neff is in some ways more engaged with Keyes than he is with either of the women in the film. But I don't think it's sexual. I think, again, and this is because Darren is a boring financial services person, it's more like he's getting a vicarious thrill out of beating Keyes at his own game, because Keyes is like the best at what he does. And Neff is like, well, hey. And there's an implication that runs through the film that Keyes sort of like, he likes Neff. He likes Neff a lot, but he doesn't necessarily respect him professionally, to the point where, like, he, when Neff is taking the call and, you know, it's Margie and he's making remarks about, oh, she sounds like she drinks out of the bottle. It's almost like Keyes expects Neff to be like this disheveled sort of like catting around individual with no respect for the work that he's doing. And he's like, I thought you were smart. Turns out you were just taller. Like, it's, there's a sense that Neff wants to impress Keyes, but in a professional sense, and to prove that he's better than Keyes by, like, beating Keyes at his own game, by constructing an elaborate insurance fraud that even Keyes can't crack.
Yeah.
You don't light a man's cigar if you're not interested in him sexually. Like, you're sending mixed messages there.
There's another scene between the two of them that I think's pivotal, though. And I think, in general, Robinson's character makes the whole endeavor a bit more palatable here. And I think that's probably one of the best things Chandler and Wilder did in adapting the novella, is kind of beef up his presence and make him a bit more likable. Because I think it's kind of crucial to the way we understand Neff as well, because I think actually he does see qualities in Walter that they are not necessarily abundantly clear elsewhere. So there's that scene, isn't there, where he offers him the job as his assistant.
Yeah.
And he's kind of offering him a way out, really. That could have been a nice jumping off point for Neff and not get any further embroiled in the whole thing, but he's offering him kind of domesticity, really. He's kind of like the stability and safety of an office job. He persuasively makes the case, I think, that, okay, it's an assistant role, but it's not menial. It would be worthwhile. So I was really interested when I put out the call for some, like, listener feedback and stuff. And one of the interesting kind of themes that comes up is how likable these characters are. And some of the people who replied didn't see it in the same way that I did. But I think that the character Keyes is crucial then in humanizing Neff a bit by kind of association.
I found it interesting that I thought the movie definitely wanted, because of the voiceover, I think we're definitely meant to see Keyes as this great man, but what we see on the screen is and I don't know how it was meant to come across to audiences at the time, but the first we see of Keyes is him bamboozling this
truck driver who burned down his truck.
Poor truck driver
who committed arson.
Oh yeah, yeah. But it out of desperation. This
whose side are you on here, Andrew? The insurance industry or the small businessman?
No, but he definitely was guilty of the crime of arson and of fraud. It's just we're meant to kind of associate with Keyes, who's beating this person who tried to cheat the system, but it's this poor ignorant truck driver whose life has been kind of like ruined, and who has this simple kind of idea. It's just like, I need my money. I burnt my truck, so I get the money now.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think it's definitely important. I felt like it was a good thing that the film established that Keyes is A, he's hyper competent, and B, he's kind of ruthless. You know, so I think then when he's kind of fishing around into the Double Indemnity investigation,
yeah,
we know that they're up against a formidable adversary, you know. But I think, like, we touched on the casting, and again, it's, you know, Edward G. Robinson, somebody made his name as a tough guy figure in, like, gangster films, something like Little Caesar, people would have known him from, you know. And I think he's great because he's kind of crotchety, you know, he's formidable. He's also slightly pitiable in some respects, isn't he? Like, when he talks about how he's unmarried and he's got this compulsion to, like, investigate women and all this kind of stuff. But he's also very humorous, and he provides a lot of the film's kind of funnier moments too, I think.
And the whole thing about him once being about to marry, that's really horrible. Because it's kind of like, yeah, I was once about to marry. Then I discovered her brother had manic depression and that she had been married before and all of the like. But that's probably, I myself and Darren are around the same age, and neither of us were like old enough to appreciate this movie when it came out. Yeah. We don't know whether the audience at the time would have responded to the, oh God, man, you dodged a bullet there. It sounds like that brother had serious psychiatric problems. And that whore of a lady was married before. And then the reaction
trash
is
from a family of trash.
A tramp
from a family of trash, yeah.
So and I how are we meant to feel about these characters? Are we meant to like Keyes?
Well, I think we are meant to find Keyes as pitiable, because he's the man who literally can't sleep because he's got, like, he describes as a block of cement in his gut.
The little man.
The little man, he's constantly disheveled. Like, he's wearing a two-piece of a three-piece suit, but he's never wearing the full three-piece suit, and it always looks like he slept in it. And he's very obsessed about what he's doing. He has no life outside of work.
We can't really criticize Keyes for his dress. Living in the 21st century,
where nobody wears waistcoats anymore. Yeah. But one of the interesting things about Keyes is when you read a lot of the commentary on the film, and particularly from people who've watched the films and who've interviewed Wilder, is that they see Keyes very much as an authorial insert for Wilder, in that he's short, he's a little stocky, he's got the same build, he's got the same mannerisms, he's very fun of cutting remarks. He's the character who, like, comes in and reminds the audience that, like, as much fun as we're having with Neff, as much, like, you know, as great as it is to break bad, it's like, yeah, this is not a good thing, and these people should probably face consequences for it.
I mean, he also has some of the funnier lines.
Oh yeah, no. Like, Wilder was a famous, like, Wilder was a wonderfully, he was an impish figure based on what you hear of him. Like, the famous story of, like, this movie was nominated for Best Picture, and it didn't win Best Picture. That went to, if I remember correctly, just give me a second.
If you remember correctly, Darren says, as he's scrolling through his phone surreptitiously, it's like, let me search the recesses of my mind palace.
But Going My Way, won the Best Picture Oscar that year, where Wilder famously stuck his foot out into the aisle to trip up the director of Going My Way when he was on his way to collect the Oscar. I knew that Andrew would laugh at that image. But that's very much who Wilder is. Like, Wilder gives these, like, and again, we're going to include lots of interviews with him in the show notes. Like, he has these really great pithy one-liners where he takes no prisoners. He's talking about, like, when Wilder was casting the film, he talked about how, like, he had to, none of the actors would do it. You know, I tried every leading man in town. I went as low as George Raft, and that's pretty low. take that, George Raft. And he proceeds to tell this story about, and it's an utterly gutting story about how Raft completely didn't understand the script that had been given to him, in, like, a really mocking sort of look at this moron sort of way that he tells it. Where, like, he's like, I'm halfway through the script, and where comes the lapel? And I've said to him, the lapel? And he said, you know what I mean. When does he show that he's an FBI man? The lapel. And Wilder says, there's no lapel. And Raft goes, I'm a murderer? And Wilder's like, yes, that is the script that you are reading. And apparently Raft just didn't get it.
Yeah, it feels like, I get this impression that Hollywood was full of these, like, specific kind of blank morons in that age. Because it, like... It was only, like, in the 70s where you were, like, where I'm sure the studios, some of the older studio heads were like, so, do we have, like, a kind of, like, a Robert Mitchum sort of guy to put in this movie? Because I hear you've been talking about putting Jews and Italians in. And it's like, yeah, we are. And it's like, yeah, but how are the audience going to associate with them if they're not 6'4" and look like a, you know, the kind of like a rectangle of scotch and cigarettes. It's interesting actually going back and watching these movies, because you see these characters in them, these kind of and sometimes it works well in a movie where somebody comes across as a sort of like a simple big fool who everything has fallen into place in life, because it's looking back at kind of that age, it almost seems like, well, if you come from a good family and are a big tall white man, then everything's good for you, like President Norton, Mr. Norton in this, like it's almost not a good performance, but it is a great performance. Because what we're meant to get from him is that he's this kind of like
completely incompetent, bumbling buffoon.
Yeah, but also very he thinks it's very important that people hear what he has to say. So the actual performance maybe works quite well.
Mm.
But and this kind of like. What you said about Wilder reminds me of it, because I'm sure Wilder spoke to a lot of
those sorts of actors,
and you see the forward and back in that scene between Keyes and Norton, where Norton is like, Keyes, what was his name? And and Keyes is like, Jackson, I believe it still is.
Sort of pithy one liner.
Well, I mean, can we go back to like this idea of like how likable these various characters are? Because like I said, I was a bit struck with the feedback I got. Like, it seemed like a couple of the listeners felt these protagonists were more likable than I did. And I was thinking about why that might be, because obviously they're murderers. And what I was thinking is this, that, you know, if the three of us were sat here discussing like Peeping Tom or Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, I don't think we'd have many emailers saying, oh, you know, such a likable guy or anything like that.
Well,
but I think, I suppose here, because you've got established stars, you know, because there's this level of wit, I suppose it's like the different ways cinema can signify things are kind of coming together to, yeah, I guess they are. They're bad people. They're doing bad things, but it's not unenjoyable to spend time in their company, I suppose. And
I mean, if you made it today, you'd have George Clooney.
I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting idea that I don't think anyone who emailed in was kind of rooting for these people necessarily. But, you know, maybe they're not as reprehensible to watch as maybe you'd think at first glance.
But I think Darren said there that if you were making it these days, you'd have George Clooney. But I think it would be George Clooney and maybe Burn After Reading, because it you have his inner monologue and he's saying, so I went to the office. I tried to get on with things. Tried to have my sharpened pencils, but I couldn't just forget about this dame. I went to a drive-in and had a beer. I followed that by some bowling, and you're kind of struck. Like, how could I hate this person? he's just kind of He seems like an idiot or a naive character in some ways.
He's so blank and so boring, which is why I think there is that aspect of Breaking Bad to it. In the sense that this is a guy who's
going back to this because it's a nice way to negate any sexuality that he has.
But I think there is an aspect of this. This is a guy who bowls, a guy who who does all the regular stuff. And it's interesting because when I see that scene of him bowling, it's a reminder of how important bowling was in American life back in the middle 20th century. I remember, is it Bowling Alone? Is the book that was written basically about the collapse of American community and sociality and stuff like that. It's the point at which bowling leagues became a lot less common in the United States around the time that you start seeing people less engaged socially and stuff like that. So it's kind of interesting that Neff is presented as a man in 1938, when the film is set, as somebody who basically bowls alone, and sort of how isolated he is.
I love as well that this is during the working day. there's a lot of It's a funny thing because we can't even look back at this movie and think, oh my God, they're drinking and driving. Because every American movie you see, they're drink driving. And it's not, it's almost not an issue. But the fact that there was a drive-in beer maybe struck us as a bit odd.
Well, I was thinking of the film's use of LA as a setting in relation to this, you know. And I think that you get the sense that comes through. Maybe they could have made more of it, I don't know, but you get the suggestion of urban alienation, don't you, I think, in that, like you said, Neff frequents places like a bowling alley or a drive-in, you know, all these places where you can be alone, but simultaneously you're kind of in and around people too. So, I don't know, I guess I kind of felt that you had this juxtaposition of, it used LA in a fascinating way because you had these sun-dappled exteriors, you know, and then you had these interior settings inside the house, which were in their own way quite gloomy, and I felt the kind of the blend of settings came together to work really well here.
And it was very LA as well, because of like all of the scenes in the drugstores, right? Where this can't be a small town in Iowa, because you're not going to go to the drugstore and have this kind of like private conversation with you, hoping that nobody around will notice you. This is
a big anonymous sort of.
Yeah, this is very LA.
What was I about to say? So yeah, just in terms of LA, actually, because there's a lot to talk about there. There's an argument I think Mike Davies makes with regards to the use of LA in film noir, and I think he singles out Double Indemnity as well in this context. Because the thing about LA as opposed to other American cities is it didn't have a really distinctive identity, particularly in the 30s or 40s. It was this mesh of sort of vaguely European styles, and it was largely populated by immigrants, and particularly like the artistic classes, the directors and stuff like that. As we mentioned, like Billy Wilder was an immigrant from Austria. He'd moved over. I think his mother died in Auschwitz, which is really depressing. And nobody, the chronology of when he found out about that, nobody really knows. But the thing is that you have this sort of combination of styles and this sort of blank slate. And in particular, like, I think Neff singles out the house in which the family is living is this sort of like Spanish, it's a Spanish style villa as well. So it's almost like that has been sort of plopped out of Spain and sort of dropped into the middle of Los Angeles, because Los Angeles is this place without an identity, without any real sort of social cohesion, which is how Los Angeles tends to be portrayed in film. It's like this urban city. It's this city where people's lives overlap without ever really... Sorry, okay, but it's like this urban environment in which like lives overlap without anybody really understanding, and everybody's anonymous, and every encounter is a sort of a quirk of fate. I mean, I kind of want to talk a little bit about like the use of class, and particularly the focus on capitalism in the film itself. Because like one of the things about Neff is a door-to-door salesman in a way, and it's suggested that he's always been a door-to-door salesman. He implies that he was selling Hoovers, I think, before he was selling insurance as well. So he has this sort of like transient quality to him. And there's a sense, like, it's been argued that Double Indemnity is in some ways a story about social striving. After a way, because like the family that Neff interacts with is very much it's a wealthy upper class family. I mean, back in the day, the husband went to Stanford and is going to his class reunion, which at the time would have been a signifier of being like a wealthy upper crust person. Now, he doesn't have any money. He's an oil man. He's lost his money like in the oil business, but he lives this life of opulent luxury and this life of comfort. I mean, Neff says, you know, it would have cost, what, $30,000 if he finished paying for it. And there's this sense of like striving that runs through the film. And like there's even the conversation with Lola, his daughter, where he refuses to allow her to see this one boy because this one boy is beneath her in terms of social class.
Yeah. And it's very much implied that it's to do with his surname.
Yeah.
Because his Zarchetti?
Yep.
Yeah,
Zarchetti.
I think it is. Yeah. It's Nino.
Nino, yeah, yeah. So, and the funny thing about Nino is that, like, repeatedly, it's kind of, like, people are always of the sense that he's not actually as bad as all evidence suggests.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of my issues, like, with the ending. If we're going to talk about Nino, we're going to talk about the ending, where it's like, it's heavily implied that he's just about ready to be complicit with murder. But it's okay because a man in the bushes gave him a nickel and told him to ring his sweetheart. And as a result, everything will be perfectly fine for him, which I find vaguely disconcerting. And that's kind of like when we talk about the influence of the code, that's the sort of weird, clear-cut morality ending that makes me a little bit awkward and uncomfortable. It doesn't fit with anything that came before.
Yeah.
Like, there's a sense that Nino is angry and frustrated, and like that he's got these impulses inside him.
I want to see Nino actually get stitched up for that murder as well. Like, properly, kind of, you know,
as it looks like he's going to be.
Yeah. And I want there to be a well, I suppose, like, this movie is probably just about perfect in terms of length.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think it was just at about the point where I was used to watching longer movies. I was like, Darren, how do you feel about watching the end of this in the morning? And it's like, what, the next 10 minutes? And I was like, awesome. Because I was fully expecting him to go
the next hour.
Get this guy stitched up, and then kind of like Neff maybe like kind of packs all his bags and gets ready to leave, and then there's this whole thing and coming back, and but it was just as long as it needed.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to the issue of class, I suppose. I mean, we touched on Stanwyck's wig, and I think it is distracting, and I think maybe they should have done something differently with that. But I suppose what it does is suggest that she's kind of tawdry and kind of cheap, I suppose. And there's a reference to her perfume somewhere. I can't quite remember what scene it's in, but she mentions a place name. And I didn't know this until I read the BFI book on Double Indemnity, but the place name she mentions is somewhere associated with like gaudy casinos and brothels and stuff like that. So you get a sense that, you know, Neff's rubbing up against, she's kind of a social climber, I guess, and she's kind of will commit murder to do it, I suppose. I mean, in terms of the code, what you were talking about there, Darren, I think you're right. You know, I think that this is definitely an issue with a lot of films of this time, that they have these unconvincing endings. And I was just trying to think, because for whatever reason, it doesn't bother me quite so much as perhaps it bothers you. And I wonder if it's because it often feels to me like the filmmakers are aware this is an obligation they need to go through, you know. And I think if you look at some of like the scene you mentioned there with Nino, or the film we talked about previously in Gilda, where the ending there is very unconvincing, it just kind of feels to me, it's like, okay, guys, we've got to get this in the can. We don't, you know, this is not really why we're making this film, but we'll kind of toss it off and, you know, we've got to do it. So I don't know. I guess for some reason, it just doesn't weigh quite as heavily on my mind as maybe it does on yours. You know, I mean, Andrew, did you feel the same way? That, you know, this film kind of, it was great all the way through, and then there were some aspects towards the end which just kind of fell a bit flat.
Yeah, a little bit. I agree with Darren in that scene where Neff is in the bushes.
I thought just go call her with this nickel. You kids live happily ever after, despite your obvious anger issues and social anxiety. I'm sure nothing bad will come of this.
Yeah, I wanted to see Neff escape, and for the police to kind of like come down on Nino, and for him to be like, "I'm innocent, you bastards," and all of that sort of drama, and for that to be the point at which Neff kind of like feels kind of like a tinge of kind of guilt. But then again, like, I don't understand how once more why we associate with Nino, because I was fully thinking that okay, this is setting up for the stuck up dad doesn't approve of Nino, but he's wrong because he doesn't see what
the goodness
is
inside him.
Yeah,
and then I thought
when we actually see this character, he in spite of maybe like putting up a tough exterior, he's actually quite a nice guy, and it's obvious that he cares a lot for her. No,
there's a really great bit where Neff is driving, and in voiceover says, "I'm pretty sure I got a wrong read on him." And like the audience is sitting there going, "We got the same read, and we're not entirely convinced."
Yeah, it's strange because Nino doesn't work in so many different ways, because he doesn't work in terms of like different endings for the movie. The one that I just articulated, where Neff goes away and Nino gets stitched up, it doesn't work in the sense of motivating any guilt in Neff, because
he's probably saved Lola from an abusive marriage.
Exactly, but all that Neff has seen, like from our perspective as the audience, is that he's probably not great anyway. So like, if I were going to stitch someone up, why not let it be Nino? and now I can see how Lola's doing, because that seems exactly what Neff would do.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that the above the line performers here are all superb. I feel like if there's a weakness to the film, perhaps it's that some of the other performers are not quite the same caliber, you know. And I definitely think that would apply to the chap playing Nino. I mean, we were talking about Freudian aspects of the relationship between Neff and Keyes, weren't we? But you could also maybe train that lens on the relationship between Neff and Lola, couldn't you? Because,
oh yeah,
I suppose one of the things that is good about his character is when we first see him interact with her, he's got this kind of paternal approach to her, which is fairly nice. But then if you think about the way the film unfolds, he kind of sleeps with her mother or a stepmother. He replaces her father in a sense. He kills her father. He replaces him in the sense that he impersonates him on the train.
But also in terms of becoming like a mentor figure to her as well. He takes her out to dinner. He takes care of her when she's sort of lost and when she needs help.
It's implied that he's the only person she can relax around. And, you know, I don't think they could have gone much further with this and got it on screen. But, you know, you could argue that he's kind of falling a bit for her. I think what the character Lola does do, though, is like if Stanwyck's this kind of unhinged, you know, bad to the bone depiction of womanhood, at least Lola then is quite sympathetic. I think it kind of mitigates that, you know.
Yeah, but it's two kind of depictions of women, and one of them are as a villain, and the other is as a victim.
Madonna and the Whore, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, but certainly, yeah, Lola is as good as it gets for a type of woman at the time. It's just like, you know, if you want to be a good woman, you can be the one who suffers rather than the one who inflicts suffering. and there's definitely for me that's not an innocent relationship. Because of when the movie is made, you don't really know in either case, but I don't think anything has kind of happened between them, but I think there's something.
I think there's a possibility that Neff is building towards it.
I think they're spending an awful lot of time together, and I think
Neff has nefarious intents, if you will.
I don't know if Neff realizes that.
Oh, I think he does.
That he has those intentions or not, but I think he definitely.
Well, even to the point that he takes that spot overlooking the Hollywood Bowl or whatever, and it seems like kind of a lover's tryst kind of setting, doesn't it? Did you guys think that?
Yeah. Absolutely, it does. Yeah,
he takes her to a Mexican restaurant where they won't be seen together because he knows it's sort of sordid and tacky. Also, because he wants the alibi, he doesn't want to be seen with her for obvious reasons. But there's a real sort of sense.
Have you had the alibi?
Great. But there's sense that, like, Neff, and again, this gets back to the whole Breaking Bad thing, where Neff is like breaking all of the social taboos, and like this is like his lost weekend. Yeah. And it's kind of like
he doesn't normally eat Mexican food,
but we're going all out now.
His stomach,
yeah. But I figure if we're going to do it, we're going to do this. But it's like, yeah, commit insurance fraud, commit murder, commit adultery,
Mexican food and psycho bread.
And there's this sort of like weird sense of like seducing this young teenager is sort of like one of those things on the like Neff bucket list of like social taboos to break.
What about you, Darren?
Not quite, but yeah. Just to go back to like this discussion of class, because class is a big part of this, is that like there's a sense that runs through this. And again, I think this is because Wilder is an outsider. And I think Chandler as well was an Englishman as well. So maybe that filters through some of his writing as well. But there's this intense focus on capitalism within the film. There's this intense focus on the idea of money and capital and measuring, in particular, like Double Indemnity is literally measuring the worth of a life in terms of money. But there's this excellent line, like, all of the investigation, the police are not a
force.
How
else would you measure it?
Yeah, but the like law enforcement and government are not a force in Double Indemnity at all. Mm. There's like, I don't think you even see like a proper police officer on screen inquiring about the death or, you know, sort of investigating the death. There's a wonderful conversation where like Neff and Keyes are talking about the death of the husband. And Neff is asking, what do the police figure? And Keyes says that he got tangled up in his crutches and fell off the train. They're satisfied. It's not their dough. And there's a sense that the only reason that Neff gets caught is not because he murdered somebody. He would have got away with just murdering somebody. If there had been no insurance policy, if there had been no money involved, if it had just been some guy who fell off a train, you know, who he'd murdered, it would be absolutely fine.
Oh, yeah.
But it's because of the money. that this becomes a thing that's investigated and looked at and deemed worthy of interrogation.
Because the police are dealing with figures as well. They don't want a whole spate of unsolved crimes where they're like, oh, it does look like this was an accident, but let's investigate this further. It's like, looks like an accident, probably was an accident. Let's clear this one off. It's done. Then they don't have to kind of investigate a murder. It's the same sort of kind of focus on figures that you have, I guess, in the insurance company.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something in there in terms of like Keyes, because Keyes is a wonderful investigator. It's almost like he reminds me of Columbo. Mm. In terms of like his mannerisms, where he seems sort of absent-minded, and there's always this sort of like this one more thing, and it's like this thing that the little man that lives in his gut. But like when he's talking about the case, he's not talking about like the death of a person and the loss of a life and the particular moral weight attached to it. He's instead talking about now.
Miss Norton, first thing that struck me was that suicide angle. Only I dumped it into the waste paper basket just 3 seconds later. You know, you ought to take a look at these statistics on suicide sometime. You might learn a little something about the insurance business.
Mr. Keyes, I was raised in the insurance business.
Yeah, in the front office. Come now, you've never read an actuarial table in your life, have you? I've got 10 volumes on suicide alone. Suicide by race, by color, by occupation, by sex, by seasons of the year, by time of day. Suicide, how committed? By poisons, by firearms, by drowning, by leaps. Suicide by poison, subdivided by types of poison, such as corrosive, irritant, systemic, gaseous, narcotic, alkaloid, protein, and so forth. Suicide by leaps, subdivided by leaps from high places, under the wheels of trains, under the wheels of trucks, under the feet of horses, from steamboats. But Mr. Norton, of all the cases on record, there's not one single case of suicide by leap from the rear end of a moving train. And you know how fast that train was going at the point where the body was found? 15 miles an hour. Now, how can anybody jump off a slow-moving train like that with any kind of expectation that he would kill himself? No, no soap, Mr. Norton. We're sunk and we'll have to pay through the nose, and you know it.
And there's a sense that, like, Keyes isn't invested in the humanity of what's happening. He's not particularly concerned that this innocent man has died. He's simply concerned with the fact that it doesn't fit within this little actuarial table of numbers that he's adding up at the end of the season. There's no humanity in there. This ties back into what Andrew was talking about his introduction with the truck driver, where like the truck driver's story is very sad and very affecting and all that, but in the end it's the bottom line you have to come down.
Sorry, the thing you're saying there about like, oh, he's obsessed with the figures and there's no humanity in it. That would be fine if he were missing the point, but he's identified exactly what's happened. Using his methods, he has understood humans better than somebody would if they were like, oh my god, your poor husband had an accident. I'm so sorry. Of course, we're going to pay out.
But he understood what happened because he stripped the humanity out, which is a very cynical outlook on this. Like, I think that there's a cynicism about like the American capitalist system in Double Indemnity, where the only reason a murder gets exposed is because somebody's going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, and that seems like a very wilder idea to me. I mean, I know you mentioned the notion that Keyes is a wilder surrogate, but there's a real bleakness, I think, that runs through Wilder's films. I mean, if you look at something like, I don't know if you guys will have seen it. It's a film called Ace in the Hole with Kirk Douglas, which he made a few years later.
I haven't actually seen it. I've heard great things.
Yeah, it didn't really go down well at the time. And I think it's just because it's so kind of cynical in its view of humanity and human behavior. I think that's very much playing into the characterization of Keyes that you talked about there. I mean, you mentioned his absent-mindedness, and I just wanted to quickly mention the kind of bit of business with the cigarette that you talked about, where he can never find a light for his smokes. Yeah.
A match.
And I think that,
yes.
First of all, I like it because it kind of, we're talking about the relationship between the two of them. So there's a level of like codependency, but also if you notice the way McMurray lights his match where he kind of flicks his thumb against it, you know, I just thought it was a really great bit of like actorly business in the sense that, again, it reinforces the idea that he's this kind of guy who thinks he's this kind of tough customer. So he's got all these little mannerisms that aren't really all that convincing in the grand scheme of things, you know.
It's funny you should mention that, because that's a recurring sort of 250 podcast trope, the inappropriate smoking.
Mm.
And like there's sequences where characters are wandering through shopping centers smoking away. By the way, in terms of like capitalism, you want to talk about capitalism, it's the fact that they plan the murder at a shopping center, at this gigantic sort of consumer market. There's also the bit where the witness who's brought in to testify and to identify that it wasn't actually the husband on the train, he says, you know, anytime you need me, I'm at your call. expenses paid, of course. And there's all this big discussion about whether or not the osteopath can be charged to expenses as well.
Yeah, but, and it's like, I'm not going to get the train now. I prefer to get it in the morning. Yeah. So it's like, presumably then they're going to have to pay for a hotel.
To stay overnight. But in terms of smoking,
Willy.
You mentioned safety matches, I think, Andrew. Andrew was very interested.
Yeah, no, I hadn't done any particular research, surprising no one. But it's these days we have safety matches, but it used to just be these things that you could light on your stubble, that you could light with the end of your thumb, that would, at one point, Keys says, like, I never carry matches because they always explode in my pocket. That was a thing that actually happened. I remember reading like an article about matches back in the day, and about how some of them were like those kind of like little mascara things where you kind of like roll it and take it out and then it just lights. But of course, like, your trousers would just catch fire.
I mean, yeah, I didn't know that these were possibly safety matches he was using then. So maybe I'm much less impressed now about his gesture with it than I was before, actually. And
I don't know if the safety match was even invented.
Okay. I mean, I always think about a quote. I think it was Roger Ebert who said this, where it's like, the only place he approves of smoking is in the movies. You know, just the sense that, especially in old films, that, you know, they convey this sense of sophistication and glamour that, you know, it's very much divorced from the reality of like smoking and so on. But it definitely shows up well on film, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely it does. But what wasn't it a thing as well where it's difficult to kind of like position how we feel about these kind of things, because I think a lot of it was cigarette companies did and perhaps still do try to encourage studios to include smoking in them. So there's kind of a question of like, do we like the way smoking looks in movies because we've seen so much kind of like smoking in movies and there's almost like a nostalgia to it, or does it just look cool? I'd say I knew somebody who was kind of like anti-smoking, who was like, well, it's not very clever, it's not very smart, it's not healthy, and then they were like, but it is a little bit cool.
Well, I mean, I would argue that like cigarette smoking, particularly in movies, works very well in terms of just lighting as an aesthetic.
Yeah,
like the idea of, because you can show light moving through smoke, particularly on a black and white screen, in a way that doesn't work without the smoke being there. And I mean, there's also like a retroactive sort of aspect of like not knowing it, or knowing it at the time but not it being not wide public knowledge, that smoking is inherently dangerous. So you have the idea of watching all these film noirs where people are smoking cigarettes, and it becomes retroactively this sort of almost signifier of danger. Mm. It becomes like they're taking their lives into their hands in the most boring and mundane way possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all dying and just dying quicker.
Well, I don't know if it's the most boring and mundane way. Could just eat loads of Haribo.
That's a fair point. sitting down, eating sugar.
It's interesting, though, you bring up, like, you know, light. And I thought maybe we should chat a bit about like the visual style of this film, because, yeah, I mean, just classic noir in the sense of the use of shadow and light, you know, superbly realized, I think. You know, you get these shafts of sunlight that run through the interior settings and like beams of light coming into the frame at like strange angles and stuff. And there was a nice little anecdote, I think I came across in one of the books I had a look at, where they used like shavings of aluminium because they'd show up on camera as kind of specks of dust. You know, and it kind of enhances the atmosphere here, I think. But one of the books I read made an interesting point, which kind of made me reassess the way I was thinking about the style. Richard Schickel, who wrote a book for the BFI about the film, he said that the style of the film, it kind of serves to like reinforce the qualities of the story. But he sort of sees it as retaining a bit more of a realistic substance in a sense, in that you get a strong, specific sense of place from the film, which we've kind of talked about L.A., but it's kind of energized and enlivened by the mood and the menace of the lighting. And I hadn't quite thought of it in those terms before, because normally when I think about film noir, I reach for terms like expressionistic and so on. But his point is that it's, maybe it is to an extent, but maybe not as much as we think it is, you know. But I definitely feel like the style gives this story a bit more heft. I mean, this could have been a very tasteless story, but, you know, the skill of the filmmaking makes it a bit more tasteful, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's a really interesting quote from Wilder when he's talking about the film, where he describes it as a documentary. And it's sort of funny that, like, we talk, that you said there, you use expressionist to describe, like, film noir, and it is highly stylized, Dutch angles, contrast between light and dark, silhouettes, the composition, the deep focus, all that sort of stuff, which would have been highly unusual for films at the time, and, like, even now looks kind of strange when we watch it and gives it, we immediately recognize, you know, the argument that film noir isn't so much a genre as a style of filmmaking. But one of the things that I really like about this is that it manages, Double Indemnity manages to both codify and include a lot of the stylistic elements that we associate with noir. Like, there are lots of really great scenes where light is filtered through the Venetian blinds to create this sort of like bars across the screen that suggests like captivity, that suggests people being boxed in and trapped, but it's never as sort of heightened or stylized as you would consider other film noirs to be. And I like that about it, because it, you're right, it does give it a more naturalistic quality. And again, I hate to come back to the Breaking Bad thing again, but it underscores how normal I am going to. But it underscores how routine and mundane Neff is. Like, Neff is a, like, the thing that's
just really horny, Darren.
Okay, fine. But my how I see Neff, how I process Neff, is he's this really boring guy who gets embroiled in this scheme that he thinks is interesting and exciting, and by the end of it becomes almost more work than it's worth doing. But, like, the sense of Wilder's sort of, like, matter-of-fact, relatively matter-of-fact, like, I mean, there's a lot of really great shots and composition. I really love that shot of the anklet coming down the stairs as a way of, like, symbolizing the moral descent of the character in question. And I really love it's a repeated shot as well. And the second time you see it, you're not sure. He's saying, I couldn't stop thinking about her. And then you see the foot moving down the steps again, and you're not sure whether it's a flashback or it's a separate scene, which I really, really like. And then it becomes clear it's the next meeting that they had. So there is, like, obviously stylized elements in there. I think Andrew Saras, who critiqued Wilder for not being a stylist, later came back and said, actually, if you look at Wilder's visual style, there are aspects there. They're just not as pronounced or in your face as they would be with other directors. But I think the matter-of-factness of Double Indemnity is a large part of what I like about it, in that it feels like Neff feels like an insurance salesman. He feels like a pretty boring guy. He feels like a guy you could be drinking with or you could be working with for years, and you would never think that there's anything particularly amiss about him. But on the other hand, you also then, through the course of this film, discover that there's quite a bit wrong with him once you dig beneath the surface. And I like that the film's sort of surface level of normality reinforces that for me, I think.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's why this was a well-reviewed film, don't get me wrong, and it did well, and it, you know, got all these Oscar nominations and so on. But if you look back at some of the contemporaneous reviews, you get the sense that people didn't really know how to describe it, you know, and maybe there was a slight element that a bit of praise that would otherwise have been forthcoming was just slightly withheld. And I wonder if that's because people would have seen somebody like Neff, I guess, as a character in a lineage of, you know, all sorts of stories at the time about bourgeois adultery, you know. So you look back at some of those old reviews and people are comparing the film not to, like, The Maltese Falcon or The Big Sleep or whatever, but they're reaching to books like Madame Bovary, for example. And, you know, there's other reviews where people are describing this as a French realist.
Or the Dollhouse, maybe.
Yeah. There's other reviews where people are using terms like French realism in conjunction with a film, but, you know, I'm not even really sure what French realism means, you know. So it's really easy to forget that, like, we see it as part of this movement. And we've already spoke about this a little bit, I suppose, but, you know, easy to forget that film noir wasn't a concept that was used, wasn't a term that had been coined, I don't think. You know, it wasn't talked about freely in America for probably a couple of decades after, you know, in terms of regular usage. And it's from a fairly disreputable source novel as well, you know. So even in terms of its literary kind of heritage, we seem to respect people like Chandler. Even Kane, maybe he's not quite on that level, regarded on that level generally, but we give him a bit more credit these days than we would have done at the time, I suppose.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about hindsight, is it allows you to sort of remedy these mistakes. And, you know, it's always good when that happens within a director's lifetime, as opposed to something that you have to go back and discover sort of after the fact. And I admire that aspect about it. It is worth noting that I think this would be, and your knowledge of film noir and the history of the Golden Age of Hollywood is much, much better than mine, Carl, so feel free to correct me, but this would be quite an early entry in the genre, I think.
Yeah, definitely early in the cycle. I mean, there's a nice saying I've came across, and I can't quite remember who it is, otherwise I'd give him a bit of credit, but it's that the classic noir cycle ran from The Maltese Falcon in 1941 to Touch of Evil in 1958. So the idea being that everything that came later than that is kind of engaging with or reacting to, in some way, the original movement. And I think you could probably kick that idea around a bit at the edges and quibble with it. But it works quite nicely as a way in, I suppose. And I mean, this film, I mean, it reportedly had quite an effect in terms of noir's popularity. I mean, you probably have to be a bit cautious in how much you attribute the subsequent rise in film noir to Double Indemnity. But there's an encyclopedia of film noir, which I've seen where, you know, there are 7 noirs in America in 44, 16 in 45, so the year after Double Indemnity is released, and then 24 in 46 released. So there's quite an obvious correlation there between Double Indemnity coming out, being well received, doing well at the box office, being nominated for Academy Awards, and then a lot of similar films, or, you know, a lot of other noirs being made not long afterwards. So yeah, it's definitely early in the cycle, but a pivotal film noir.
By 1947, they were making as many film noir movies as Raymond Chandler could write. So he could write about, 52. Let's say, 52 a week. 52 a year. One a week, $700 a pop.
Actually, just to go back to Chandler, actually, because you mentioned Kane and Chandler and the dynamic that exists between them. One of the things I find interesting, one of the interesting arguments I've read about Double Indemnity is that it works so well because it combines the simplicity of Kane's plotting, because Kane, you know, was not an overly complicated writer and director. He was not sort of somebody who was, like, you know, especially sort of nuanced and had, like, curves and sort of, like, twists and turns in the stories that he wrote. But so it combined that simplicity with Chandler's knack for dialogue. Because Chandler is generally perceived, for better or for worse, or accurately or inaccurately, as a writer who has this wonderful knack for, like, hard-boiled dialogue. And there is a number of really brilliant exchanges in this. We talked earlier about the "suppose I'm a cop, suppose I pull you over," sort of back and forth, this witty repartee.
The Mike Detective one is like, that's a dirty mouth you have. It's like, suppose I put a leash on it. And it's like, suppose I'm a robot dog from the future and can bite through the leash. Yeah. It's like, what are you?
The thing is that, like, the argument is that Double Indemnity, and the story is that, like, Chandler's iconic novel, The Big Sleep, when they're adapting that for film, William Faulkner was working on the screenplay, and they actually had to ring up Chandler at one point and ask, so we're working through, we're breaking down the story, it's a great book, we're really excited to be adapting it, but who killed the chauffeur? And Chandler responded, I have no idea. In his own novel. So you get, like, Double Indemnity has the simplicity of a relatively straightforward arc, a very story that's very easy to follow. But on top of that, then you can have all the Chandler-esque sort of embellishments, the little details, the dialogue that pops, the characters who sparkle. And I think that's a wonderful sort of combination.
I absolutely agree, because I think the film's kind of embellished by all sorts of memorable moments that are pretty extraneous, really, in narrative terms. But it's just stuff that I adore. So I think of, you know, Neff not being able to hear his footsteps as he walks down the street, you know, and he talks about it's the walk of a dead man, you know, and that must have come from Chandler, I sense. And the description of murder smelling like honeysuckle, and it's everything that you were just saying, really. It's that I think Chandler had a great gift, a great turn of phrase, really good at using metaphors and similes in his writing. I've read all of the Marlowe books he wrote, except one, I believe, and that shines through in all of them. And, I mean, Wilder was no slouch in this area too, so I think the combination of them, you know, obviously we talked about their personal kind of disagreements and so on, but I think it's a situation where, despite that, they kind of got the best out of each other, you know? Just wanted to run through these listener comments if I can, and...
Absolutely.
And, I mean, we've touched on a lot of the pertinent issues anyway, but let's see. So, Chris said, and this is back... You know, this is at the heart of what we were talking about, really. I love that the femme fatale isn't really why he commits the crime. Neff wants to show he's smarter than everyone else. She provides the opportunity and he takes it, I believe, knowing at heart what she is, what he is, that it will all go bad. He just can't resist trying. I mean, I don't know, guys. I do like that taking it, but I feel like it's much more motivated by kind of a primal lust. But obviously we disagree, I guess.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Carol. I think, like, we do, if we have that urge, no amount of red flags is going to talk us out of it, I guess.
There's actually a really nice moment in this, and it sort of reminds me of, I think, American Animals recently, where Neff is talking about how he's waiting for a sign from above to tell him not to do this thing, and it just never materializes, and it's like he's just willfully blind to the red flags, because obviously Q Keyes shows up and offers him a job, which is very much an out. But like, he's actually so fixated on doing this thing that he doesn't see that as an opportunity or a red flag or like a get out of jail free or get out of like getting shot in the shoulder and bleeding to death free card.
Like, don't get me wrong, I do generally walk away from a femme fatale, but it's not because they're kind of like not appealing. So I'm now
reminded of the Wayne's World 2 plot involving Garth with Kim Basinger.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of sorry.
But yeah, I would agree with Chris. I'm on Team Chris on this one.
Of course. Surprising cool. No one.
Well, Gabriella came at this from an interesting perspective too. So she says, this is pretty much my favourite film noir, followed closely by Murder, My Sweet and The Big Sleep. Barbara Stanwyck is incredible. Every scene she's in shows what a consummate actress she was. And it's also interesting that neither she nor Fred McMurray are truly bad people. They're just people who've done a bad thing for reasons that take the audience a long while to truly understand. And I mean, McMurray maybe, but Stanwyck's character seems pretty bad to me, to be honest. I mean, I know she has this very unconvincing last minute thing where she can't fire the second shot or whatever, but
you know. I can't properly murder you. I can only half murder you and let you bleed to death.
I don't think he's going to bleed to death. We've spoken in this movie, in this podcast before about stabbing and how you can stab a person and they'd be fine. Similarly, you can shoot somebody in the shoulder as she appears to do. Like, he'd be grand. He probably is in shock. And is losing blood. But
just on this, actually, it's worth noting, I don't think we discussed this, but the original ending of the film, because they changed the ending of the novel. The novel originally ended with the two characters on a boat contemplating suicide, throwing themselves to the sharks, which is not an ending that would necessarily... You should see Andrew's face here, by the way. That's not an ending that would work cinematically. So they changed it, but the original ending of the script ended with Neff going to the gas chamber. So the ambulance coming, fixing him up, and then having the final shot of his execution. Wilder shot that, and they're actually photos
Of
that.
It's like the final scene in Psycho.
Where they explain the movie that's happened at this point.
It like undercuts
the tension. But Wilder figured that he had enough from the ending with the two men smoking cigarettes. But I've always read that ending as meaning that Neff dies, as taking it as Neff, you know, doesn't get to the ambulance.
So innocent.
Okay, fine. But by the way, I actually...
Darren's never been shot or stabbed.
To be clear.
He's never met a femme fatale.
I've never had all of these life experiences. Andrew is my guru in this regard.
He's waiting to break bad. Yeah. By that he means, one day he's not going to follow all the procedures.
I'm only going to fill out the form in duplicate.
Actually,
weirdly enough, I have more sympathy for Stanwyck's character than I do for Neff's. I honestly feel a bit of sympathy for Stanwyck's character being trapped in this situation. Now, I know it's entirely of her own making in that she tried to marry in, she got into this marriage that is completely unhappy and unsatisfying with a point of view of trying to get the money out of it. But I kind of feel bad that she's trapped in this gilded cage. Whereas on the other hand,
it's all context.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh, so you tried to marry into it to get a little bit of money. And she's like, yeah.
Yeah,
that's kind of like what good options are there for me?
Well, she's trapped in this relationship. Yeah, well, she murdered the man's first wife.
Yeah,
so my sympathy is limited, I must say. Sorry, there is the scene, isn't there, where she talks about how he slaps her in the face and stuff like that, but. We don't know the truth of it.
That's her perspective, and you don't know that. I mean, there's the wonderful scene where they're driving.
Oh, I believe her, Darren.
Okay. Way to load that, Andrew. But there's a scene where they're driving to the the train station, and like Neff is crouched in the back, and this is really the first time he's seen the two of them as they think is alone. And she's like, "Oh, you'll be going away then," and he's like, "I should be back next week." And now the delivery of the line doesn't exactly scream concerned spouse worried about his wife being left alone and understanding that intimacy is important in adult relationships. But the fact that like his immediate response to, oh, you're going away for a week, isn't, yeah, and won't you be glad of that? Or, oh my God, I'll be so glad to get rid of you. His immediate response is, I'll be back. Suggests that maybe there is something resembling compassion in him. And the only version of him that we've really seen is filtered through her perspective. But again, there's not enough there that I really feel confident reading it one way or the other.
Yeah, and like she wants... She wants money, and I think that's kind of it. Like, I don't know.
Money and better wigs.
I don't think she really wants a man.
Yeah.
So much, and there's something kind of almost freeing about that.
Yeah.
I like both Stanwyck's performance and Phyllis as a character.
Yeah.
She is wicked, but she's doing wicked things because they've presented a dichotomy of Phyllis on one hand, and is it Laura?
Lola,
is it?
Lola,
the daughter.
On the other, and given the choice, I'd rather be Phyllis. I don't think I can judge her too harshly, in spite of the fact that she's done
terrible things.
Yeah.
I think they present two types of women, and she's the one who's perhaps.
And there always seems something optimistic.
It's what she represents rather than what she's actually kind of doing.
Yeah. And I mean, there's something in the way that Neff behaves towards her where he seems to be commodifying and objectifying and depersonifying her, where he never really refers to her as Phyllis. He only refers to her as Phyllis once or twice. It's always Mrs. Dietrich or Babe, which seems like it makes it suggest that she could be anyone to him. That, like, if he'd wandered into any other room with any other woman, he'd be plotting to murder her husband if she just gave him the slightest nudge. I do feel bad for her, whereas I feel like Neff was always going to do something like this. I feel like, I don't know, I have a bit of sympathy for Phyllis.
It's interesting that you mentioned the names, because I think that's one thing that Chandler changed. I think in the original, it was Walter Huth and Phyllis Nerdlinger, and I think the alterations definitely take away like the comic edge to it, you know, and that was for the best.
Mrs. Nerdlinger.
Yeah. And this hits on what Linda J. Sandahl said in a message to me, which was like, one thing you can mention is that the script by Chandler improved the novel in exactly the right way, even though Chandler and Kane didn't get along at all. Chandler could see exactly what needed to be done and did it. And I think we've kind of talked about that throughout this podcast. Sean said, so I just want to run through these, you know, a few more. Sean said, watch this last night, not for the first time. We shouldn't be rooting for Neff and Phyllis, but we do. We know it's not going to end well. Superb A-list cast, Raymond Chandler's script with Wilder fits together like a watch.
That's a great point.
Then a couple of people raised something that we haven't mentioned over the course of this discussion, which I think is a great moment too. It's that scene where Keyes comes to the apartment and Phyllis turns up just after, and she hides behind the door. So, yeah, a couple of people like Max Mason have said, okay, I get it. Phyllis had to hide somewhere, but doors don't usually open to the outside into hallways and corridors. Still my second favourite film of all time.
It's a fire safety violation.
I mean, I believe in some European countries, though, doors do open outwards. But I think he's definitely right. That is a contrivance. It works really well.
It does indeed. And I mean, like, this is part of the thing where the framing device... And again, I don't want to pick on the film. Because I love this film very much. But the framing device
is... The door framing device?
Yeah, it's very weird, right? Because it implies... Like, you know for a fact that, like... Obviously, Keyes doesn't figure out what's happened, because he has... The whole premise of the movie is Neff explaining to him what happened, which would be redundant if Keyes had ever actually caught them. So you have this weird sequence in the hallway where, like, is Keyes going to catch Phyllis in the act and come down on them and figure out what's going on? And as a result, is, you know, Neff going to have to murder him or whatever? Or is this going to escalate? And the very existence of the framing device means that you know on, like, a fundamental level that it won't or it can't. Now, it's to the credit of Chandler and to the credit of Wilder that the tension in that scene is fantastic and it rings you so tight. But I remember watching that and thinking, this is a very strange setup for a movie given the framing device that we've wrapped around it.
And you could apply that to another moment as well, which I really love. It's kind of improvised by Wilder, I understand. It's after they've put the body on the tracks and they try and leave in the car, but the car won't start. And that's something that apparently had happened to Wilder kind of on his lunch break or something like that. So he called all the actors back. He said, you know, and the thing is, of course, they're in a model car. There's no ignition in the car, really. So it's all pantomime. You know, there's no key. But he's kind of telling them.
I love that. I love that scene.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And Wilder apparently, McMurray's like, Billy, this is taking too long. But no, he's like, no, do it slower. And it's just elongated for exactly the right amount of time, I think. And that's a great moment too, in my opinion.
Exactly. The fact that it starts running as well makes it better. If it, like, because
all Neff has to do is just lean over and turn it once and it starts working, which is a really nice sort of like cherry on the scene. It's a nice sort of capper. Because it takes what is a really tense scene and sort of makes it almost comical.
He's good at lighting things. Like any type of ignition, he just excels in.
Yeah.
Like that's what he should do instead of
murder.
Let me just read a last message from Victoria Kodai, who said, "This was an absolutely brilliant film. One of my favourite noirs. I drew inspiration from this for a film I'm making." So ooh. I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for Victoria's film and share the information about
that
online.
Let us know.
But yeah, absolutely. And
maybe we'll be covering it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was really pleased that people got in touch, and it's, you know, obviously a film that's held in high esteem by those who've seen it, it seems.
It is indeed. And again, including the three of us on this particular podcast as well. It's an absolutely stunning film noir. It's up there with Sunset Boulevard. In fact, like, the suggestion is that you should watch, and I think you mentioned this at the start, you should watch Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity as a double bill almost, because they fit together so perfectly.
Yeah, you could do. You could do that. You could do a triple bill with Ace in the Hole, or you could do like a Billy Wilder, Raymond Chandler thing where you go back and watch The Lost Weekend immediately after and you know, perceive the things you were talking about with Wilder's relationship with Chandler. And like you said, one of those things where the kind of retroactive acclaim for The Lost Weekend, it seems very much like it was a case of Double Indemnity deserved all the awards last year. We don't want to miss, you know, miss the bandwagon with this Wilder guy.
Yeah.
Let's kind of shower him with acclaim now. So. But yeah, no, Wilder's one who people should dive into his filmography, you know.
It's like Pacino as well with Scent of a Woman. Like that's when
it's the Lifetime Oscar.
When Denzel Washington is asked about kind of the Oscars being so white and like how did he not get an Oscar for Malcolm X? And he says, well, like that was the 8th or 9th time Pacino had been up for that, and he finally won it, and it was probably on account of like some of his older performances as well, and the injustice of him not getting it. So he was like, kind of like, maybe the Oscars aren't Italian enough either.
I quite like my favorite statistic is I think that Charlie Chaplin's only competitive Oscar is for the score to Limelight in 1973, 20 years after the film was released. Would have hated to have been one of those guys nominated for soundtrack, I think, that year.
In terms of specifically with Double Indemnity onto The Lost Weekend, it reminds me a little bit more of how like maybe something like Whiplash didn't quite get the glowing reviews that La La Land did, you know, and maybe there's a sense that there's an element of atoning for that when La La Land came out, that, hey, we weren't quite as attuned to, you know, what Whiplash represented. That seems like a kind of a decent-ish kind of analog to me. But yeah, no, you're definitely right.
All right, so I think that sort of about wraps up. But so the Movie Palace, tell us a bit about what's coming up on the Movie Palace, Carl.
Okay, well, there's during November, hashtag Noirvember is something that goes around, it seems like, on, you know, on the classic film Twitter, as it were. So we've done Double Indemnity. We did, hopefully, a film noir primer a couple of weeks ago. Haven't recorded it as we're sitting here talking, but hopefully we'll have got to listeners before this episode.
It's reassuring that other podcasts work like that too.
We'll also be having a look at The Maltese Falcon and one other film noir in November before December. Hopefully we'll be a little bit cheerier.
Just sort of in the season. I like that. You gotta go down to get up. It's the roller coaster effect in reverse, basically. So we're the 250 as well. So we will be covering we'll be doing our usual stuff in November. I'm not quite sure what our next films will be. And we sort of come out of a spate of like, we've just done Halloween, we've just done our anniversary show. So we're just going to get back to business as usual. So stuff like Beauty and the Beast, Once Upon a Time in America, City of God, Fight Club, that's all ahead of us on the 250 coming up.
We're also trying not to date this. So if you're listening to this in October, then don't be too surprised, but you're not, because let's see if our listeners can guess like when this was recorded. Yeah.
Just retroactively using all the contextual clues there.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Carl. If listeners are looking for the Movie Palace online, where can they find you?
I'm most active on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod. Less active on Facebook, where I have put a page up on there. So facebook.com/Movie Palace Pod. And the podcast itself can be found, you know, on iTunes, Spotify, various places where good and not so good podcasts are found.
I think you're very much the 250s movie twin there, because we are also relatively active on Twitter, less active on Facebook.
I've said that I'll set one up, but do you know what? I don't think we really need it. and also that it's like a thing I've promised to do, so I just don't think I'll do it.
That's a very good attitude. Yeah. I appreciate it wholeheartedly. But you can find us online at the 250. You can follow Andrew at
AQUINNIUQA.
You can follow me at Darren_Mooney and the 250 at the 250. You can find us on Stitcher, on iTunes, wherever good podcasts are sold. Take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.